The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. We are reading today from the May 9th, 2014 issue of The Week magazine. The main stories and how they were covered. The NBA's crackdown on a racist owner. What happened? Facing a league-wide walkout by players, NBA Commissioner Adam Silver this week imposed the maximum penalty on Los Angeles Clippers owner Donald Sterling for his racist comments on a leaked audio tape, fining him $2.5 million, banning him for life from any involvement with the team, and taking steps to force him to sell it. A scandal that shook the foundation of the sports world erupted when gossip website TMZ.com published a recording of the 80-year-old real estate billionaire berating his mistress, V. Stiviano, age 38, for being photographed with black men, including Los Angeles Lakers Hall of Famer Magic Johnson. "It bothers me a lot that you want to broadcast that you're associating with black people," Sterling said in the recording. "You can sleep with them," he adds. "The little I ask is not to promote it on Instagram and not to bring them to my games." With the league in an uproar, Silver used every bit of his authority to punish Sterling for what he called his hateful opinions. The commissioner invoked a clause in the league constitution that affects the NBA or its members adversely. That clause requires a three-quarters vote of approval from the team owners. "I had their full support," said Silver. Sterling reportedly said the team is not for sale and may fight the league's actions in court. What the editorial said. In a sport in which almost 80% of the players are African Americans, said USAtoday.com, Sterling's plantation mentality is disgraceful. He and Nevada rancher Cliven Bundy, who recently suggested that African Americans were better off as slaves, have demonstrated that racism is alive and virulent in America. The real question is why the NBA chose to ignore Sterling's history of bigotry until now, said the New York Times. In 2009, the slumlord settled a $2.7 million housing discrimination lawsuit, and in 2003 was accused in another federal lawsuit of not wanting to rent to blacks because he said they smell and attract vermin. "Sterling is a crank and a jerk," said the Wall Street Journal, "and it's good to push racism down when it rears up in such a public way. But his comments, and those of fellow outlier Bundy, aren't proof of endemic racism in a population of more than 300 million people. Sadly, some on the left exploit ugly incidents like this to serve a political purpose." What the columnist said. "Let's not pretend Sterling and Bundy are the last two racists in the United States," said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post. "They have company. If you don't believe me, read the reams of racist hate mail I get every week. Sterling, let's remember, employed a basketball team full of black men, and yet he believes in racial segregation as the way things still ought to be. He's not alone. Many big city school systems are as segregated as they were in the 1960s, and some Tea Party crackpots can't stand the fact that there's a black man in the White House." "This scandal has made one thing clear," said Mark Tracy in NewRepublic.com. "The NBA is now a players' league. Basketball's most marketable superstars, like the Miami Heat's LeBron James and the Clippers' own Chris Paul, have influence like players from no other sport. Their newfound sense of empowerment came into its own this week when these young black wealth creators gave the commissioner and owners a simple choice: Sterling or them. Sterling deserves no sympathy for his odious comments, said Jeff Jacoby in the Boston Globe. But on occasion, I have yielded to impulses in private that I would be loath to be judged by in public. Haven't you? What concerns me most is not the rantings of an 80-year-old plutocrat, but the rapidly disappearing presumption that the things we say in our personal lives will stay personal. Racism is ugly, but allowing modern technology to make our private lives everyone's business is even uglier. You could be next. Our controversy of the week: Piketty, that's P-I-K-E-T-T-Y. Will his soft Marxism change the political debate? The hottest book in America this week isn't about boy wizards, teenage vampires, or a young woman who likes to be spanked, said Kyle Smith in the New York Post. It's Capital in the 21st Century, a ponderous 685-page tome by Thomas Piketty, 42, a ridiculously far-left French economist who's become an overnight rock star. If the title sounds familiar, it's supposed to. Piketty's Capital is an unabashed sequel-slash-homage-slash-reboot of Das Kapital, the 1867 Karl Marx magnum opus that spawned the horrors of communism. Like Marx, Piketty argues that capitalism is an inherently flawed system that oppresses the working classes and created immoral levels of inequality. Piketty's ideas may be distinctly left-wing, said James Pethakoikis in NationalReview.com, but they're also well-argued, and we conservatives dismiss him at our peril. Piketty provides meticulous evidence that income from owning property, businesses, stocks, and other wealth is rapidly outpacing the wages from labor. Unless conservatives quickly rebut Piketty's new soft Marxism, this lone Frenchman could single-handedly reshape the political economic landscape on which all future policy battles will be waged. Piketty is neither a Marxist nor a radical, said Lynn Paramore in Salon.com, which is why he has conservatives terrified. His book, now Amazon's number one bestseller, is the product of a sober 15-year research project of 2 centuries' worth of economic data that irrefutably debunks conservatives' belief that a magical force that drives capitalist societies towards shared prosperity. The trend is actually in the other direction, Piketty shows, and if we don't do something about it, the top 1%, indeed the top 0.01%, will continue to amass more and more of the wealth, while people who work for a living fall further and further behind. Piketty also demolishes that most cherished of conservative myths, that America is a meritocracy in which great wealth is earned and deserved, said Paul Krugman in the New York Times. He proves that most of rich people's money comes not from the work they do, but from the assets they own, some of them inherited. No wonder the right is suffering from Piketty panic. If Piketty's liberal fans were actually to read his book, said Ross Douthat in NYTimes.com, they might panic themselves. He says they, too, are the problem. His definition of the wealthy includes the top 10%, well-off, often liberal professionals, who send their kids to elite colleges and leave them a valuable house and a sizable trust fund. Neither they nor conservatives need worry much, said Michael Barone in NationalReview.com. Piketty's solution to inequality is absurd. He proposes that Western governments get together and impose an 80% tax on incomes over $500,000, as well as a new progressive tax on every kind of asset and property. That's obviously not going to happen anytime soon. Clearly not, said Jordan Weissman in Slate.com. But by refocusing the inequality debate on wealth rather than income, Piketty's work may make a real impact. American voters aren't eager to slap very high income taxes on the rich, whose ranks they hope to join one day. But what they hate even more is the idea of aristocrats, of a ruling elite whose children and children's children are destined to lead lives of ease and influence. Think, say, of Paris and Nikki Hilton. Piketty's book arms liberals to argue more persuasively for major increases in the taxes on capital gains and inheritances. That's what we ought to be fighting about, not whether the top income tax rate should be 36 or 39.6%. And it was a good week for retreads, with the news that Star Wars 7 will soon be filmed and will include original stars Mark Hamill, Luke Skywalker, age 62, Carrie Fisher, Princess Leia, 57, and Harrison Ford, Han Solo, age 71. It was a good week for the 1%. After the wife of a wealthy Chinese businessman rented a mountain to teach their 9-year-old daughter about nature. If I can afford to rent a mountain, why not? Reasoned Gan Lin. It was a good week for hitting the high notes after the Colorado Symphony Orchestra teamed up with the state's booming marijuana industry for a 4-part Bring Your Own Cannabis concert series. The symphony's CEO said the concerts are part of an effort to reach out to every segment of our community. It was a bad week for Trout River, Newfoundland, after a dead blue whale washed up on the beach there and swelled up like a giant balloon. The stinking decomposing well, filled with methane, couldn't be moved because it might explode, officials said. It was a bad week for career choices. After a would-be bank robber in Florida unsuccessfully demanded cash from a teller who was protected by bulletproof glass, and then left behind a stick-up note written on the back of a job application containing his identifying information. It was a bad week for clinging. After Buddhist monks spent 5 days building a multicolored sand mandala in Jersey City so it could be destroyed in a ceremony symbolizing life's impermanence. A toddler beat them to the punch by stomping on the mandala. What can we do? Shrugged a monk. While we're here, there's a boring but important blurb on e-cigarette rules. The Food and Drug Administration has unveiled its first set of proposals for the regulation of electronic cigarettes, the tobacco-free devices that enable users to inhale nicotine-laced vapor. The proposed regulations would ban the sale of e-cigarettes to minors and would force manufacturers to disclose the ingredients they use, place warning labels on products, and stop handing out free samples. Critics pointed out that there was no ban on flavored e-cigarettes, online sales, and television advertising, despite claims that these tactics are aimed at luring teens into becoming customers. The FDA said additional restrictions might be imposed, but only after there had been more scientific research into the health risks of vaping. Take a look now at the briefing page. Secrets of the Black Box. When planes crash for no apparent reason, flight recorders can help solve the mystery. if they're found. What is a black box? It's a device that helps air crash investigators determine what went wrong by providing a detailed record of a plane's final hours. Passenger jets normally carry two of these shoebox-sized containers, one holding a voice recorder, which captures pilots' conversations and other cockpit noise, and another housing a data recorder, which logs the plane's speed, altitude, direction, fuel flow, hydraulic pressure, and hundreds of other metrics. These steel and titanium black boxes, which despite their name are actually painted orange to make them easier to spot, are fire-resistant, waterproof, and engineered to survive being smashed into the ground at over 300 miles per hour. Most flight recorders are stored in the tail section of the aircraft, which is usually the last point of impact in a crash. When were they invented? Devices that could log very basic flight data were introduced at the start of World War II, but none recorded cockpit audio. Then in 1953, Australian scientist David Warren was asked to investigate a spate of mysterious crashes involving the world's first jet-powered airliner, the de Havilland Comet. I kept thinking if only we could recapture those last few seconds, it would save all this argument and uncertainty, he said. Warren developed a prototype machine that recorded pilots' voices as well as instrument readings. It was supposedly nicknamed the Black Box by a reporter who was mystified by its workings, and by the mid-1960s, the equipment was mandatory for all commercial planes. Since then, the technology has improved, with data now being stored on durable flash memory rather than magnetic tape. How have the cockpit recorders helped investigators? The black box from United Airlines Flight 93, one of four planes hijacked on September 11, 2001, confirmed investigators' suspicions that hijackers deliberately crashed the aircraft into a Pennsylvania field to stop passengers storming the cockpit from gaining control of the jet. "Shall we put it down?" one terrorist can be heard saying, as the sound of fighting grows closer. "Yes," another terrorist replies, "pull it down." In other cases, background noise captured by the recorder has provided vital clues. In 1987, for instance, a South African Airways 747 jet aircraft crashed into the Indian Ocean, killing all 159 people on board. When the voice recorder was recovered 2 years later, it revealed the sound of popping circuit breakers, a sign of an onboard fire. How are these boxes recovered? On land, search teams just look among the wreckage. Recovery is more complicated if the plane goes down in the sea, like missing Malaysian Airlines Flight 370, which is thought to have crashed in the Indian Ocean in March. Each black box is fitted with a water-activated beacon, which emits a sonar ping every second for at least 30 days. But search teams have to come within a couple of miles of the box to pick up those pings. In the case of Flight 370, the initial search area was more than 660,000 square miles, making the odds of finding the boxes quite slim. "We're not searching for a needle in a haystack," said Mark Binskin of the Australian Defence Force. "We're still trying to define where the haystack is." Once a beacon's batteries run out, the chances of recovering a black box decrease even further. Recorders from at least seven planes that crashed in the sea have never been found. Are there other problems with black boxes? Apart from being hard to find, they also don't provide a complete record. The devices store about 25 hours of flight data, but only the last 2 hours of cockpit audio. In most crashes, that's enough to determine what happened. With Flight 370, it might not be. Investigators suspect the crew was probably incapacitated during the flight by a fire, loss of cabin pressure, or a climb to a very high altitude, and that the autopilot flew the plane until it ran out of fuel and dropped into the ocean. If that's the case, the audio recording would just consist of 2 hours of silence. Can the technology be improved? Some experts have suggested that airliners introduce black boxes that eject on impact and float on water, technology already used by the U.S. Navy. The United Nations is also examining proposals to wirelessly stream cockpit recordings and flight data to computer servers on the ground, so investigators would immediately know why and where a plane went down. Pilots' groups have opposed this technology, arguing that constant monitoring would violate their privacy. But the bigger issue is cost, about $100,000 per plane for installation, and much more to keep transmitting the data. Airlines are very cost-sensitive, said Mary Schiavo, former Inspector General of the Transportation Department. They simply will not add additional safety measures unless mandated by the federal government. Following the disappearance of Flight 370, though, many governments might look more favorably at streaming. Navies and airplanes from around the world are searching for this plane, said Mark Rosenker, a retired U.S. Air Force general. That's not cheap either. There's an interesting insert in the briefing column. It's called, "Damn It, We're Going to Crash." The black boxes recovered from Air France Flight 447, which went down in the Atlantic Ocean in 2009, offer a chilling glimpse into the plane's final moments. Problems began when the jet flew through a storm, causing its airspeed indicators to freeze and autopilot to disconnect. Perhaps spooked by the sudden switch to manual control, inexperienced co-pilot Pierre Cedric Benon pulled back on the stick to put the plane into a steep climb, making it lose speed and triggering automatic stall warnings. "We've totally lost control of the plane," said co-pilot David Robert, as the captain returned from a nap. "We've tried everything." Bonin continued pulling back on the stick, making the plane lose even more speed and go into a stall, until the captain finally realized the mistake. By then, the plane was falling. "Damn it, we're going to crash," said Robert. "This can't be happening." At 2:14 a.m., just 4 minutes after the autopilot disconnected, Flight 447 plunged into the ocean, killing all 228 people on board. Take a look now at some of our best columns. Best column from the U.S. from Ron Fournier, the nationaljournal.com. How Obama Lost the Millennials. When he ran for president in 2008, Barack Obama inspired a generation of young Americans to shed their apathy and cynicism to vote in record numbers, said Ron Fournier. The millennial generation believed his promise that he'd transform Washington. 6 years later, Obama has lost them. A comprehensive poll of millennials by the Harvard Institute of Politics reveals steep disappointment in Obama and government in general. In 2010, 51% of Americans ages 18 to 29 said they trusted Obama to do the right thing. Now it's just 32%. The same percentage of young people who said they trusted George W. Bush in 2006. Is this entirely Obama's fault? No. Young people are also disgusted by the partisan gridlock engineered by congressional Republicans. But they took Obama at his word that he'd be a transformational president, and they now see the two-party system as stale and irrelevant. Obama, they believe, became part of the system. He got held hostage by it, and he surrendered to it. You have to wonder, will they ever trust a politician again? Here's a column from the United Kingdom. Ron Little at the Sunday Times says, "Meet our corniest minority." The Cornish are no longer just a bunch of inbred yokels, but a recognized ethnic minority, said Rod Little. This new protected status comes courtesy of the European Union, which must have invoked the European Framework Convention for the Protection of Pixies and People Who Have Been Too Generously Apportioned Fingers and Toes. It seems that the natives of Cornwall, Britain's southernmost county, don't consider themselves part of England, that awful, oppressive, and imperialistic thing from which they get all their money. As evidence, they point to their distinct Celtic language, spoken by precisely 557 of Cornwall's 500,000 people. Is that as their predilection for eating meat, pastries, and sickly tooth-rotting fudge enough to render them a protected species? Apparently so for the EU. This is, of course, just a lot of nonsense, as is so much that Brussels churns out in its increasingly desperate attempts to undermine the notion of the nation-state. The weaker people's ties to their national governments, the stronger Brussels feels itself to be. Yet your average Cornishman can be expected to be less than euphoric. The new minority status, after all, won't help him find a job. Here's a column from Pakistan, from Saad Rasool at The Nation. Does the ISI go after journalists? As our top television journalist lies in a hospital, riddled with bullets, Pakistan is aghast at the accusation that our shadowy Inter-Services Intelligence Agency could be responsible, said Saad Rasool. Hamid Mir, a news anchor for GOTV who has reported on the ISI's alleged killing of separatists in southwest Pakistan, was told he was on the agency's hit list before gunmen shot him last week. GEO immediately ran an hours-long rant against the ISI, accusing its director of personally ordering the shooting. Now the agency is trying to have GEO shut down and its editors jailed for slander. Pakistanis don't know whose side to take. If the authorities are assassinating dissidents, we should support GEO. But what if it's wrong? Frankly, it's unlikely the ISI attacked Mir, because he would be dead if it had. Still, the fact we take the possibility seriously is a damning judgment on the intelligence agency. The truth is, the civilian democracy and the ISI have grown suspicious of one another. We can bridge that gap not by silencing GEO, but by more discussion, elaborate coverage, and unfettered commentary on the conduct of the civilians as well as the ISI. Our in-depth article this week, the section called The Last Word, is titled, One More Shot at the Show. For veteran players like Scott Ellerton, says John Feinstein, a comeback requires a return to the minor leagues. Even though he had been out of baseball for most of 4 years, Scott Ellerton felt completely comfortable walking into the Phillies clubhouse in February 2012. Many of the players had no idea who he was because professional athletes' memories rarely extend back more than about 15 minutes. In Baseball World 2012, Cal Ripken Jr., who retired in 2001, is an old-timer who played in a lot of games. Willie Mays is a distant memory, and Babe Ruth is the name of a league for teenage players. Ellerton had won 56 games as a major league pitcher in spite of numerous injuries, including 17 for a bad Houston Astros team in 2000. But he hadn't been in a Major League Baseball clubhouse since 2008, and even though he stood out at 6'7", a lot of players had no idea who he was. It's not like anybody looked at me and thought I was some hotshot prospect, he said with a laugh. I probably look every bit of 36. 7 months earlier, even Ruben Amaro Jr., the Phillies' general manager, hadn't recognized Ellerton. That was in August, when Ellerton had called to him while standing on the field during batting practice prior to a game between the Phillies and the Colorado Rockies. Ellerton was watching BP with his 7-year-old son when he noticed Amaro standing a few yards away and, on a complete whim, decided to try to talk to him. After Ellerton had introduced himself and introduced his son, he said something to Amaro that surprised him, even as he spoke. To this day, he isn't quite certain why the words came out of his mouth. Ruben, do you think there's any chance I could make a comeback in baseball? He said. Do you think I could pitch again? To Ellerton's surprise, Amaro didn't answer him with a response along the lines of, are you insane? Or even a polite blow-off. Instead, he shrugged his shoulders and said, if you'd like, I'll send someone to watch you throw once the season's over. Ellerton couldn't ask for more than that. Amaro gave him his card, and they shook hands, leaving Ellerton standing there wondering what in the world he had just gotten himself into. As it turned out, Amaro was as good as his word. Ellerton had gone home to Lamar, Colorado, the town of just under 8,000, where he had grown up, and had begun throwing on a regular basis with Josh Bard, a former major league catcher who lived nearby. He wasn't counting on a call from Amaro, but he wanted to be ready just in case. He could feel the adrenaline each time he threw to Bard, and as the season wound down, he began to believe, maybe just a little bit, that he wasn't entirely crazy. Shortly after the World Series ended, Amaro called. He was going to be in Denver for a banquet in which Shane Victorino, then with the Phillies, was scheduled to receive an award. If Ellerton was interested and could make the drive to Denver, he would watch him throw the morning after the banquet. Ellerton and Bard made the drive early on a November morning, and Amaro met them at a local school. Amaro had him throw about 50 pitches in all. Ellerton thought Amaro would tell him that he'd be in touch. That would leave him with some hope. Amaro didn't do that. I'd like to sign you, he said. If you give me your agent's information, I'll get in touch and we'll work out a deal. 4 months after that meeting, Ellerton walked into the spacious clubhouse at Bright House Field and found a crisp, clean uniform with the number 59 on it hanging in a locker that had his name on it. A number of veteran players, guys he had pitched against in his first baseball incarnation, came by to say hello and welcome him. If you've been a player, a baseball clubhouse is a very comfortable place to be if you're in a uniform, he said. Even if you haven't been around for a while, if you're in uniform, then you feel like you belong. If you're not in uniform, then you don't. It really doesn't matter who you are or who you've been. That's the way it is. Players talk often about the fear of someday not having a uniform or a locker anymore. Ellerton had taken that step further when he had shown up in Denver as a civilian, as players call anyone who's not in uniform. Putting on a uniform again, even surrounded by so many unfamiliar faces, was comforting. He arrived in Clearwater, Florida, with a simple goal: pitch so well during spring training that it would be impossible for the Phillies to send him down. Realistically, there weren't any spots open, especially for a starter, he said. All you had to do was look at the rotation, and you knew there wasn't any chance. They had stars and veterans. I hadn't pitched, except for 3 starts in Charlotte in 2010, since 2008. Intellectually, I knew the deal, but as a competitor, I was going there to show them I was still a major league pitcher. If I didn't think I was good enough, there wasn't much point in my being there. The first 3 times Ellerton got into games, he showed them. when he was on the mound facing real hitters, it all came back like riding a bike. His unorthodox delivery, all arms and legs coming at the batter from his 6-foot-7-inch frame, had hitters who hadn't seen him before way off balance. First three times I pitched, I didn't have to pitch from the stretch once, he said, smiling at the memory. It almost felt like I was back in Houston and it was 2000 again. That was the year Ellerton won 17 games pitching for the Astros before injuries and a taste for the nightlife sent his promising career off the rails. 12 years later, back in the March heat of Florida's West Coast, he was 25 again. He could tell by the looks he was getting from his teammates in the clubhouse that they were noticing. And then, not surprisingly, he came back to earth. It wasn't as if he crashed. He descended more slowly than that, pitching reasonably well, but not lights out the way it had been at the start of camp. As March came to a close, he knew the numbers he had been concerned about in February were clearly stacked against him. Nevertheless, with a week left before the team broke camp, he was still on the roster. I was in early one morning to work out before I was supposed to throw, he said. I was on a bike when pitching coach Rich Dubé came in. I said, "Hey, Rich, what time am I supposed to throw this morning?" He just looked at me and said, "Need to talk to you in Charlie's office." Charlie Manuel was the Phillies manager. Ellerton knew he wasn't being invited in for breakfast. In baseball, there are two reasons you get called into a major league manager's office, and both are bad, Ellerton said. The first one is if you're being taken out of the rotation or benched. That's not good. The second one is a lot worse. This was the second one. Ruben Amaro was sitting with Manuel when Ellerton walked in, a clear sign of what was to come, if Ellerton had needed one. Both men were very complimentary about Ellerton's spring. He had worked hard, done everything they had asked. They believed he was capable of pitching in the big leagues again if he could improve his command. A pitching term that, in English, means being able to throw pitches to the exact spot where a pitcher wants them. Missing by an inch can be the difference between a swing and a miss and a line drive. But as he knew, the team was blessed with starters like Roy Halladay, Cliff Lee, and Cole Hamels, not to mention guys like Joe Blanton and Vance Worley, who weren't stars but had solid big league resumes. Manuel finished with the inevitable line ball players have been hearing for as long as the minor leagues have existed. "Go down and keep working hard, and there's a good chance you'll be back up here. It's a long season." Ellerton was disappointed, though not surprised, yet also elated. He had gone from standing behind a barrier trying to wave Amaro down the previous August to being on the cusp of making a big league roster 7 months later. He knew Manuel's words, although cliched, were true. It was a long season, and if he pitched well in AAA, there was a chance he would make it to Philadelphia. He believed he was good enough. He thanked Amaro and Manuel for the chance they had given him and packed up his locker to move across the complex to the minor league camp. The walk from the big league clubhouse to the minor league clubhouse took only a few minutes, but it was as if Ellerton had traveled through time and space to another dimension. Baseball players understand that no one goes straight to the big leagues. Once upon a time, an occasional player might bypass the minor leagues, either because of extraordinary talent or because a team needed instant publicity. Nowadays, no one does that. Even phenoms like Steven Strasburg, Bryce Harper, and Mike Trout spend some time in the minor leagues. But they all assume their journey will go in only one direction, up. They all believe that once they walk out of a minor league clubhouse heading for the big leagues, they aren't coming back. Of course, many do come back. Some end up on an escalator that takes them up and down to the point where they feel dizzy. Scott Ellerton had ridden the escalator, particularly near the end of his first baseball incarnation. even dropping briefly back to AA at one point. You rationalize it by saying it wouldn't have happened if you hadn't been hurt, he said. But after a while, it doesn't matter. You look around, and there are plenty of guys who have been hurt, plenty of pitchers who have had shoulder surgery more than once. You want to think you're going to wake up one morning and you're going to be 25 and your shoulder is going to be completely healthy. Then you wake up and you realize that's never going to be the case again. One morning I woke up and decided it was time to go home. That is, until that summer afternoon in Denver, standing behind a barrier with his son when he decided it was time to try again. One more time. And so, on this late March morning in Clearwater, Ellerton stood for a long moment and looked around at the packed minor league clubhouse. Then he took a deep breath and went to find his locker. No one even looked up at him. He was another face in the crowd. He was back where nobody knows your name. This was taken from the book Where Nobody Knows Your Name, copyright 2014, by author John Feinstein. On the health and science page, the most Earth-like planet yet. Have we found Earth's twin? For the first time, astronomers have identified a planet outside our solar system that is both Earth-size and orbits its star in the so-called Goldilocks zone, where temperatures may be just right for supporting liquid water, and therefore life. Researchers discovered the planet while reviewing data from NASA's Kepler Space Telescope, which has spent the past 5 years hunting for habitable worlds beyond our solar system. The new discovery, known as Kepler-186f, is less than 500 light-years away and part of a five-planet system orbiting a red dwarf star in the constellation Cygnus. While astronomers cannot confirm the presence of water or detect a protective atmosphere, they have calculated that 186f is just 10% bigger than Earth and circles its sun every 130 days. Since similarly sized planets in our solar system are made of rock and iron, scientists say, 186f is likely to have a rocky surface. What's more, red dwarfs, which are cooler, dimmer, and smaller than our sun, are among the most common stars in the galaxy, raising the possibility that many more such worlds are out there. This is really a tip-of-the-iceberg discovery, Jason Rowe of the SETI Institute tells the Los Angeles Times. We can infer that other ones are likely to exist. And our health scare of the week, kids and codeine. Despite persistent warnings about the potential dangers of codeine for children, doctors have barely changed their prescription habits. New data from the National Hospital and Ambulatory Medical Care Survey, which looks at more than 189 million ER visits by children ages 3 to 17, shows that the rate of codeine prescriptions to children dropped by a mere 0.8% between 2001 and 2010. Codeine is typically prescribed for coughs and colds and to treat pain. But it poses a particular danger to kids because they metabolize it differently than adults do. Too quickly in about 8% of the cases, meaning a standard dose can potentially prove fatal. And while it's ineffective in roughly 2 out of 3 children, it can trigger adverse effects such as rashes, hives, constipation, and vomiting. The American Academy of Pediatrics, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, and other health groups have issued warnings to discourage codeine use in patients under 12. Codeine's been around a long time, Dr. Alan Wolf of Boston Children's Hospital tells CNN.com. Just like many other drugs, there's a complacency about it. We're on the Talking Points page now. Affirmative action. Should race still matter? Blistering, scathing, and outraged, said Robin Abkarian, in the Los Angeles Times. Those were three words used to describe Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor's passionate 58-page dissent last week after her fellow justices voted 6-2 to uphold Michigan's ban on the use of affirmative action in university admissions. Michigan voters approved the ban in 2006 on the grounds that race-based preferences to achieve diversity were unfair and fostered resentment among the white students who lost out to less qualified blacks and Hispanics. Now, thanks to the Supreme Court, the door has been opened for any state to ban affirmative action in its public universities. Chief Justice John Roberts and the court's conservatives like to pretend we're now in a colorblind nation, said Dahlia Lithwick in Slate.com. But in Sotomayor's dissent, which she chose to read aloud, she sharply reminded her white, male, privileged colleagues, race matters. Even today, she said, young black and Hispanic students come from homes with rates of employment, unemployment, and poverty double those of whites, and when they try to compete at the highest levels, still face daily slights, snickers, and silent judgments that make them think, I do not belong here. To Sotomayor, this is no abstract legal argument. Having grown up in a poor Puerto Rican family in the Bronx, she personally benefited from affirmative action, eventually graduating summa cum laude from Princeton. But discriminating on the basis of race inevitably creates a problem of elementary fairness, said John Pondhoritz in the New York Post. Why should a talented and hardworking white child of a poor waitress lose out to an upper-middle-class minority student whose grandparents suffered discrimination decades ago? Given how the world has changed, affirmative action no longer works, said David Frum in TheAtlantic.com. When the practice was introduced by President Lyndon Johnson a half-century ago, even the most affluent black citizen of the United States could expect to face humiliating economic and social discrimination. Today, class trumps race, and racial distinctions have grown blurry. Only one in six Americans now marries a person outside his or own, one in six Americans now marries a person outside his or her own race, making the task of educating racial preferences ever more baroque and absurd. Does the child of a dark-skinned Cuban with an Irish father qualify? What about the mixed-race children of African-American Rhodes Scholar and a white millionaire? That's why today's affirmative action should focus on class, not race, said Richard D. Kallenberg in NYTimes.com. Skin color is no longer a clear indicator of privilege, but wealth certainly is. The income-based achievement gap is now twice the size of the race-based achievement gap. Meanwhile, 92% of black students at elite colleges come from families in the top half of income distribution. Clearly, both black and white students at the bottom of the economic scale are being left behind. Class is important, but it's also not enough, said Jamil Bowie in Slate.com. While Americans like to imagine a future of mixed-race mutts where color distinctions disappear, the reality is that the country remains highly segregated. The vast majority of blacks, including those with middle-class incomes, live in neighborhoods with high crime rates, low property values, and poorly funded schools. And despite the progress of some African Americans, most remain poor, with 4 in 5 coming from homes in the bottom 40% of income distribution. Black kids who grow up in poverty start out with a huge disadvantage, and it strongly affects their performance in high school and on standardized tests so critical in college admissions. Consider class alone, and you'll miss this entirely. Decades ago, I was probably admitted to the University of Michigan because of affirmative action, said Stephen Henderson in USAtoday.com. And I know it helped me get my first job at a newspaper. You can argue that I and other minority students didn't deserve these opportunities if you like. I beg to differ. Last week, I won a Pulitzer Prize for commentary. But what disturbs me is that affirmative action was supposed to be a temporary fix, to be shelved when de facto equality was achieved. 50 years later, most black students still are trying to fight their way up from poverty and failing inner-city schools. Today, only 5% of the University of Michigan students are black. Affirmative action worked for me. What is going to work for the next generation? Another of the talking point articles, climate change, the new abolitionists. Comparing anything to the abolition of slavery is always treacherous terrain, said Christopher Hayes in The Nation. But when it comes to the challenges of tackling climate change, there really is no other precedent. For this planet to survive in any recognizable form, scientists say, we have to limit the amount of global warming to about 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit. To do so, we somehow need to persuade major nations and the largest oil and gas firms to leave from $10 trillion to $20 trillion worth of fossil fuels in the ground. The only other time an industry has given up that much wealth was back in 1865, when the South was forced to surrender the slaves, but only after the bloodiest, most horrific war we've ever fought. It's admittedly an imperfect analogy, but it does illustrate the enormity of the challenge facing environmentalists. To save Earth from catastrophic climate change, melting ice caps, rising sea levels, extended droughts, famine, climate justice activists must persuade big oil to accept the abolition of fossil fuels. Those bastards in big oil, said Bill Zeiser in The American Spectator. How dare they subscribe to the antiquated notions of property rights? Hayes, a left-wing MSNBC commentator, really has gone off the deep end this time. Hayes doesn't seem to understand that fossil fuels have created most of the wonders of the modern world, said Tim Kavanaugh in NationalReview.com, including transnational markets for food, widespread travel and education, and the middle class. Since fossil fuels provide 80% of the world's energy, how would Hayes replace all of the oil, natural gas, and coal that makes the modern world work? With windmills? Hayes is right about one thing, said Megan McArdle in BloombergView.com. To slow climate change, we need to cut way back on burning fossil fuels. But if we did, you and I would suffer as much as big oil. Would you accept having a much smaller home? Little heat in the winter, no air conditioning, no gas-powered vehicles, and no meat, fruit, or vegetables from distant farms? Abandoning fossil fuels would leave everyone on the planet much, much poorer. So realistically, the only way to halt climate change is to pour resources into developing entirely new energy sources to replace fossil fuels. Or if that fails, a way to remove huge amounts of carbon from the atmosphere. Abolition won't keep those fossil fuels in the ground. And we'll pick up a third talking point article today. Bundy, a revealing choice of words. Why was anyone surprised when Cliven Bundy turned out to be a stone-cold racist? Asked Paul Waldman in the WashingtonPost.com. The Nevada rancher became a hero on Fox News, talk radio, and conservative websites 2 weeks ago, when he and a gang of armed protesters stared down federal agents from the Bureau of Land Management in a dispute over grazing rights. But Bundy forced his admirers to flee in chagrin when he said last week that the Negro may have been better off as slaves. Since at least then, blacks learned how to pick cotton rather than live on government subsidies. Bundy's defenders may have been embarrassed by a choice of words, said Adam Serwer in MSNBC.com, but his basic sentiments are hardly unusual. For years, conservative speakers have espoused and conservative audiences have applauded the argument that black poverty is the result of welfare state dependency, not a legacy of slavery and racism. Indeed, Bundy was just restating, in uglier words, Republican Representative Paul Ryan's recent assertion that poverty is the result of men in the inner city not knowing the value and the culture of work. Republicans should learn a lesson from this, said Kathleen Parker in the Washington Post. When they embrace cranks who point guns at the federal agents or Tea Party nuts who wave Confederate flags, they only help liberals indict the whole party. There are racists who vote Republican, but are all Republicans racist? Of course not. Are some Democrats racist? Asked Kevin Williamson in NationalReview.com. You bet they are. The same liberals who condemn every critic of the Obama administration as a racist fall strangely silent when their allies indulge in racial nastiness. Barack Obama sat in church for years listening to racist harangues from his pastor Jeremiah Wright. Infamous race baiter Al Sharpton has a show on MSNBC. Hypocrisy, anyone? Let's stop wasting our outrage on racist words, said LZ Granderson in CNN.com, and start focusing on the true mainstream manifestations of modern racism. Real racism is gerrymandering minorities so their votes don't count, equating the murder of an unarmed black teen with standing your ground and systematically sneering at poor people as takers. Racism today may look and sound different from how it did when men like Bundy could openly express their contempt for blacks, but the song is still the same. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.